Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Graham?
Yeah, good, good.
Fantastic. To me, it's still the middle of the night, but I'm gradually
Right.
becoming a lark, which you both inveterately are. Good morning, Mel. How are you?
Morning.
Fantastic. Okay, how's your week been?
Well, nothing very dramatic. It passed by.
Yeah, well, let's be thankful for small mercies. I'm delighted. Perhaps we could start with the optics of Trump's Dreamtime the second, and this phenomenon of what some are describing as loyalty over competence. What
Well,
does
we
that
don't know
bode,
that.
do we think?
We don't know how competent people are until they get into office. And that was the case with for example, the incoming Labour government that in the UK that and there does seem to be a sense of purpose that I'm not sure. There seems to be more clarity of purpose, I think, than there was in the previous Trump regime. He has had 4 years of experience of it now. Now, whether that's a good thing or not, of course, depends on whether you think the direction is right. But the He's I don't know, so far it's been an interesting selection of people, but he does seem to know the areas in which he wants to act, in particular around culture wars, around climate change, sadly, and those sort of areas. And the American people elected him pretty, convincingly. This was the first time of his three that he's had a very clear majority of the popular vote. Clearly, what the Democrats were offering did not particularly attract the American people. So I'll see where he's going, but it's I don't know, so far it's a fairly sure-footed start, I think. As I say, that can be a good thing or a bad thing depending on whether you think the direction is right.
Yeah, we know where we're going to some extent, but at least we know with whom we're going. There is this thing lurking, isn't there, called Project 25, of which he first of all denied knowledge, and now I think the author of this particular missive held quite a sort of a highfalutin reception in Manhattan this past week. It's since been published. I think it's some 922 pages. Some people find it a bit impenetrable. Some people find it coruscating. So there is a sort of, as it were, there is a core text to work from. Have you had a gander at this, Graham, at some point, or a suggestion of what it might entail?
The Heritage Foundation,
Ah, they're
Graham.
the people, yes.
Well, I heard when it was discussed earlier, some of the horrific things inside it, that Trump denied in order to get elected. So, if it's going to be implemented, then it's pretty horrendous.
We seem to remember, as one might expect with a Republican administration, Obamacare is going to be one of the targets. Benefits for seniors. Take us
Well,
from there, would you, Graham? What sorts of things could we expect?
deporting 25 million people, I think.
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. Which logistically is going to involve the spending of quite a lot of money. I think there's been mention of using former military bases to do this, but even then.
I think it's pretty horrendous. I don't agree with people thinking, oh, well, he won't be so bad this time. I mean, it's just the total uncertainty. And now he's got Musk on board. We can gather what he's going to do with tariffs and so on. But no, I mean, the people who are being appointed are usually unknowns as to their performance. Although they're quoting some pretty horrendous stuff that they've said and done before.
Sometimes I
Especially.
suppose it being American performatively.
The ambassador to Israel, for instance, has said he doesn't recognize the term Palestinian. He only recognizes Judea and Samaria.
Presumably
Trump's
by
never been to
averting his
Palestine.
eyes and just skipping bits in the relevant history.
There's never been a Palestinian state as such. I mean, and it was under various mandates over the years. It's the discussion there is more about, intention, I think, of the direction that that war might be going. But in one sense, given that, that area has never had a, there's never been a Palestinian state with a Palestinian president and elections for a Palestinian parliament or any of the trappings of statehood. It's a, it's a view. It's certainly one that is going to be challenged in areas, but it's not. I think, like in the previous administration, there's a danger of just writing off the oddities of the way Trump does business, because he's actually rather more effective than people think he is in many ways, I think.
Whatever his ends might be. I suppose the thing you mentioned, business, I mean, the thing with the Middle East is the vast expenditure involved, and the fact that the Biden administration, in even since it's giving a last, hopeful, possibly not last, dollar of money to Ukraine, has also signed off a large, I think, consignment of fighter jets headed for Israel. And this has been a consistent pattern for, well, for decades, hasn't it? And as a slice of the national pie, presumably Musk the heretic might have cause to look at this. And of course, Trump's avowed intention to bring the thing to a rapid end.
Yeah, but you have to, as Malcolm said, he's got skills that are unappreciated, like being able to get elected. I mean, the way he got elected is just by lying. And so
I suppose it's a skill, yes.
well, that's the skill. It's who the best liar wins. And it's against one of the Ten Commandments. So he's going against his religion and he's going against his constitution. So he's going to destroy the country. And I mean, that
Creative
is.
destruction, isn't it? The Hayekian term.
It definitely fits in with Turchin's analysis. The method is to analyze which elite is destroying which other elite, and Trump is out to destroy the
Now, there's the
opposition.
thing, isn't it? The fact that already fights are breaking out with the Republican Party, and not just the old guard versus the new. Leonie, good morning.
Morning.
Welcome back. And you on that noble mission for the City Hall Remembrance Service last Friday.
Yes, sorry.
I hope you've had it. No, not at all. It's a very important mission. How's your week been?
It's getting a lot better now. I've not actually been very well for most of the week, so
I can hear a touch
I
of flugging in your clack, my dear, but yes, just a
yeah, it's
touch.
not been ideal. So I'm sort of just getting back into doing a few things, but no, I've been pretty much grounded.
Oh, goodness me, that's not a good thing. You should be taking flight. It's the earliest dispatch. And thank you for making time for us amidst the vestigial lurgy. As you'll have gathered, we're talking about, I'm trying not to say it, Trump's, well, initial appointments. People keep saying picks, but I think that's a little bit sort of monosyllabic. And some of these people appear to have no direct experience of the briefs to which they're being allotted. Mal is of the opinion that, they're unproven, give the guys a chance. But Graham has been talking, I suppose, in terms of that Hayekian creative destruction, that sort of move fast to break things. We also have the Heritage Foundation lurking in Project 25. What's your reading of all this?
They are picks at the moment because I think some of them have to be signed off by the legislative bodies.
Ah,
Certainly, I
yes.
think they get interviewed and everything, and there are already unbelievably Republicans who are saying that they're not going to pass them through because some of them are. My favourite so far probably has been picking an anti-vaxxer conspiracy theorist, RFK Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr., to be the head of health. And he's already apparently run something somewhere, and there was a big measles outbreak because he doesn't believe in vaccinations. So, America, you're welcome. This is what you chose. So that's quite an interesting suggestion that you're going to have a guy who doesn't believe in healthcare in charge of health. Then he's picked a woman who has been on a watch list because of her closeness with Russia to be the head of national security. So you're going to have a Russian spy in charge of your security, as some people have put it. I mean, I have no idea if this woman really is a Russian spy, but that's what people are saying about her. And so it goes on. So people who don't believe in health in charge of health, people who don't believe in national security in charge of national security, people with very little experience. Oh yeah, the guy who's the Fox News host, he has done a few other things as well, to
Defense,
be fair.
Jeremy.
Yeah, to be in charge of defence. Anyway, so people are jumping up and down about quite a few of them all this week. But I think some of them will have to be interviewed, and they will be subject to some sorts of controls. And then it's going to come down to whether or not some of the Republicans in the House and in the Senate are prepared to vote against some of this lunacy. Because I don't agree with Malcolm. I think putting people in charge of things who are unproven but have very little experience and are being put in because of their ideological convictions or just because they've been big mates with Trump. I mean, that is not that's no way to run a railroad, as they say.
I'd
I
love that
remember
deep resonant
one.
American accent there, Leonie.
Yeah, it's the best I can do at this time in the morning.
It's pretty impressive. But I suppose we've been here before in the Johnson administration, haven't we?
Which Johnson? There's quite a few Johnsons.
There are quite a few, yes.
Yeah,
Johnson and Johnson?
do you
No,
mean
surely not.
LBJ? You mean Lyndon Johnson, or do you
I
mean
am sorry.
Bush?
I was thinking of the bouffanted one.
Oh, what, the man with the cufflet on his head, as someone pointed out in a
Indeed,
photograph.
indeed, yes.
Yeah. Well, he yes, he did put in some people who were rather unusual into various positions, but and he certainly put some people who appear to have no experience of very much at all into the House of Lords. In fact, one of them had so little experience of anything that and was very young that look and looked and is also blonde. Lots of people just said, "Oh, that's his daughter."
Indeed, it's not Ugandan affairs, no, indeed.
Well, not with his own daughter, I
No,
hope.
indeed, indeed.
Well, that's people have said many things about him. I don't think that's one of them.
No, thank goodness. Anyway, but there's some people compare that sort of behavior to that of, say, a beleaguered sort of back to call a Roman emperor. I think America's, who am I thinking of? Gore Vidal used to talk about the American Constitution very much in terms of the Roman Senate and its infighting. Are we in that sort of territory here? And what is the rational play out of these things? I mean, already, as Leonie's alluding to, there are rumors of a constitutional crisis with the Matt Gaetz department as he goes to Attorney General. And presumably, as over here, he would have some sort of eventual oversight as to who is picked to join the regime incrementally as it proceeds.
Well,
Well, the checks and balances in the US Constitution didn't work particularly well during the last Trump administration, despite the fact that he didn't control the whole of Congress. This time he's got Congress on, he's a stronger position of any president for a very long time, of having all of the levers of power pretty much within his hand, give or take some dissent within the Republican caucuses. But even so, we saw, and we've seen it in this country as well with both major parties, that when when wrongdoing goes on, a political party, instead of rooting it out, tends to gather around and defend it and find excuses for it. And there comes a point where public starts to think everyone is all the same, which is unfair because there are many extremely honourable members of Parliament on all sides. But the way that their leadership sometimes behave makes that less obvious than it should be. So I'm not sure that how effective attempts to hold back Trump and his agenda will be now. I suspect they won't be very very effective at all.
We still have the some who say that the vestigial traditional Republican Party, as we've seen in some of this week's reactions, and indeed the general constitution over there, are a little bit wary of being of the cage being rattled, as it were, albeit by the popular vote. The actual play out of this is going to be pretty awkward.
Well, you know, America has voted for it, and he's got the popular vote this time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be quite hard to gainsay him. I think the only way that they'll be able to do it is if some of these picks they do actually refuse in Congress, because they go and they're interviewed, and they fall short, because. You know, that is, I think, the one time would be to prevent some of these people that he's picked out this week from going into office in the first place. Now, whether any of the Republicans in the House or the Senate would be willing to, go against Trump, because they know how badly Trump has treated people who've gone against him before, that is another question. I don't know, how likely that is to happen. He will have control of both the Senate and the House, but it will be by very slim majorities in both cases. So, you know, it will be possible for, you know, if there are still Republicans left who, don't want to see their country made an international laughing stock, because I think that's what will happen. I mean, and as for all the people who said, oh, I'm not sure I can vote for Harris because, you know, she supported Israel. Well, you know, I hope you're really happy with what you've got now instead, because it was always obvious that Trump was a far bigger supporter of Israel than the Democrats were. Mm. And certainly picking this guy who's, refused to call settlements, let alone illegal settlements, and has referred to the Palestinian territories and the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. When Trump was president before, he moved the American embassy in a very provocative move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So they had evidence of what was going to happen. So if they actually thought that not voting Democrat was going to be helpful in some way to the cause of the Palestinians, then they were completely not looking at the evidence from, you know, when he was president number 45. So may you reap what you sow, because you wanted this, obviously, because you were, you know, you didn't look or you didn't understand. Or, I mean, how could you not have known?
He will some imams, didn't he, on stage for about 4 minutes and said, these are great people, as he did in those egregious Ferguson race riots, good people on both sides trope. And then suddenly they're off again. Harris didn't get that far, apart from a back committee of Palestinian activists.
Have you seen, he's also picked the people who were his lawyers in his hush money trial, he's also picked them to go into the administration as well. I mean, he's just going to pardon himself from all his 74 felonies now as well, isn't he? Or as many of them as he can. Not all of them are federal charges. There are a few charges at state level that he won't be able to pardon himself from, but he's going to pardon himself from everything else. I mean, the man is a charlatan. It's not just about lying. He's a complete charlatan. And the idea that he's better at business. I mean, listening to some of the Republicans during the campaign saying, when he was president, when he was 45, there were no wars around the world. You know, oh, well, I mean, obviously there was a big link between when things happened and when Trump was in charge. And also the idea that the economy was on its knees because of the Democrats when they'd had both COVID and also then the war in the Ukraine, this massive global shock that has resulted economically, you know, causing the cost of living crisis here. Anyway, you know, they've taken advantage of it, and they will now, the Americans who either voted for it or, you know, couldn't quite see for some reason or another what he was like. So I'm going to sit back and laugh a lot, I think.
Well, indeed, what can you do? It's through a glass darkly, somewhat, isn't it? I mean,
but I wonder whether the point is that they knew exactly what he was like. They've had 4 years of it in the White House, and 4 years as a mayor. And what we shouldn't leave out of the equation is the where the Democrats are, and how they made so many serious faux pas that. I'm reading some of the tweets about people who'd always voted Democrat but didn't do so this time. And it is remarkable how often the culture wars issue, and particularly the promotion of women of men into women's sports and prisons and you know, girls changing areas, had the most successful ad that Trump ran was the one where he said, "You know, I stand for you, she stands for they, them," which on the polling seemed to suggest that there was 3% of independents changed over to Trump having seen that particular advert. And any single advert that has a 3% effect on the polls is enormous. And the Democrats, I think, will need to come to grips with whether following that agenda as vigorously as they did was actually, yeah, it may well have been enough of a factor to have determined at least some of those swing states. And the Democrats, it seems to me, are just so out of touch with so many people in the states. We shouldn't, you know, over-exaggerate this. They still picked up 70 million votes. But the you know, elections aren't just a one thing. And in particular, the old adage that governments lose elections rather than oppositions winning them. That's an element that I think comes into the equation in really quite a big way in the States at the moment.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, I think, I was, you know, saying to people a long way out, I'm actually just going to assume that Trump is going to win this. And people were like, "You're kidding." And I was saying, well, you know, he pretty much had it in the bag, and then, you know, Biden dropped out, and she surged for a while, but during September and October, it's not been looking good, and people keep saying it's too close to call, but, you know, that was what I was sort of tending towards, and you're absolutely right. Apparently, the Republicans spent £21 million on that one theme, Malcolm. You know, and she's as far as most Americans are concerned, she's a woke Californian lawyer, and most people in America are not woke. Most people in America are not particularly enamored of Californians, even though there's quite a lot of them, and most people are not mad about lawyers either. And you know, that whole you know, she couldn't persuade. You know, and this whole thing about making abortion rights front and center of the ballot as well. You know, he converted a lot of people over last time because he was very strong around that. And they basically said, well, we're going to ignore everything else about him because he's going to protect the unborn. And, you know, that brought over a lot of white working class people, evangelicals came over last time, and he's just, you know, that the whole demographic of Hispanic Latino voters, that the you know, I think the Democrats have been taking people for granted here and then running around espousing these causes, and it hasn't landed well with, you know, ordinary Americans. So I completely agree. I think it's a combination of him being prepared to absolutely lie through his teeth, And the Democrats completely playing the election wrong. I've had friends who've been out there and they've been walking into rooms and then, as some of these points have been put across as being part of the Democratic platform, the whole room has fallen silent and people have looked at the floor and haven't been interested. So it's not as though the Democrats didn't know it was happening, because apparently that's what, they've been seeing on the ground. So this whole joy thing that she was talking about as well, I mean, get a grip. You kept hearing vox pops where people were talking about the cost of groceries,
Yeah,
and they never
I think
addressed
not
the
much joy in that. Yes, indeed.
no, they never addressed the groceries issue, and there have been a lot of undocumented migrants have been arriving in the States, and that has been, I mean, to be fair, Trump was talking about building a wall and didn't build a wall last time, but they didn't land any blows on the Republicans over Trump's failures the first time around. So, and no, I think people haven't understood that he knows how it works this time. So he's going to come in, and it's not going to be chaotic, and it's not going to be a mess. And you can see that with, he's making his picks now. They're very clearly, his own idiosyncratic way of approaching politics. And this is not the way it happened last time at all. It was a bit of a mess, if you remember. And then he had to keep sacking Bill. People realized how, he's bringing in people who will run the administration so he can spend his time on the golf course again, which is what he did before. But and it's I think it's going to be a lot worse than it was last time. I really do.
Yeah, so the only saving grace is that, for example, I think he brought in, was it Betsy DeVos to run the education department in order to wind it up at a fairly early stage? Likewise, the environment portfolio. I don't know if this is going to happen this time quite the same way, because what needs to be repealed and the amount of time that will be taken. But Graham, what's the constitutional argument here in terms of the continuity and the apparent, well, the need presumably to pass law to or reversals of law in order to wreak the what some people might describe as the whirlwind.
Well, I think the cause a rift between the federal administration and the state administrations, and the state administrations will get together, which they already have been doing in a very big way, to counteract the negative
Quickly
factor.
way.
Well, in particular in global warming, I mean, they're simply not going to accept his climate denial, and they're organizing already. Very effectively to implement renewable energy. And that's one thing that Kamala Harris lost out on. She refused to, or she, I thought she'd playing the Ming strategy as Starmer did without publishing many policies. But she as Leonie said, it's she missed out on the price of costs of living, and that's the key thing that people were concerned with. So they obviously didn't read their electorate. So I think it's they're going to be the electorate's going to be extremely disappointed, and Democrats do have, as Malcolm said, 70 million supporters still. And they're pretty upset. I mean, they were crying at her succession speech. So I think, I mean, they haven't come back particularly quickly, but I think they are slowly getting their act together to resist. And it would be a question of a resistance forming against Trump, in particular against Elon Musk. I think you get boycotts coming in quite substantially.
Somebody I met a few years ago did an epic drive from north to south in America as a sort of sabbatical, and went off grid a little bit and found that alongside most freeways, there are these shadow communities, the sort of Flint, Michigans of Michael Moore fame, which never really get any attention in optics. And I suppose this is where the cost of living is going to hit particularly hard, that you won't find the Trump ad targeting trailer parks, but at the same time, people feel drawn into his vision of how they might somehow be able to afford, through zeal and enterprise, their weekly grocery bill.
But I think they have to say how their wages are going to increase. And Keir Starmer has made a great speech at the COP about reducing emissions by 81% by 2035, which is a very good ambition and sets the tone for the COP, which is being completely counteracted by the fossil industries, claiming that gas and oil and gas are gifts of God. Which is also the American approach. I think the head of a coal organization said he had spoken to God and had been told by him to carry on mining coal.
Blimey. And you think of Justin Welby from the oil industry, I don't think he might have counter that argument.
Well, I think that's another example of elite destroying the elite in power. You know, I mean, he wasn't directly concerned with what he's accused of. He did make mistakes and everything that he's been accused of. But the point was, you can't help thinking that it was the fact that they missed punishing the culprit and therefore were going after the establishment. And they're succeeding. And as soon as they got one head... the head, they're going for the rest. They're going downwards. So that's a typical example of elite fighting an elite.
Yeah, and of course, if you're a political party coffers keeper, you always have to look over your shoulder as to when you're next going to need a donation to achieve whatever you're going to achieve next. I mean, Trump has no particular qualms in this department, does he? Whereas the more liberal-minded, I suppose, sometimes have to make difficult compromises.
Yeah, Trump is a gang leader. I mean, he does it by force, which is how he's held the Republican Party. I mean, people are afraid. I mean, that the figure of 38% of people are now afraid in America is a staggering figure.
Which I suppose some people might say as a result, you know. Keep them lean, or something like that. In another part of the... Yeah, sorry.
This is the way the gangs operate. You know, they go on... It's very difficult not to see a war coming because people are going to get seriously upset overseas as well as nationally.
You mean sort of a form of civil war, civil insurrection?
Well, no, I mean, when they start carving up Israel and Palestine, I mean, Balfour Treaty was that they're going to share the state. And so I think, you know, the Middle East is not going to acquiesce in the destruction and genocide of the Palestinians.
Yeah, a trenchant thought to park, perhaps, for a moment. In our part of the forest, Rachel Reeves was at Mansion House this week talking about, I think, a template that's also been adopted in Norway and Canada, particularly a bit of Australia, whereby local government pensions are going to be harnessed to tend big infrastructure projects. I'm wondering if, for example, British Energy is going to be part of this. And involves some £50 billion, if I remember rightly. Is this a, I'm sure, well-calculated gamble? And what does it do to people's sense of, I suppose, citizenship buy-in? Is it something that should be something to debate before it's implemented? Stakeholding is the word I'm looking for.
Well, she can't make it happen. I mean, it's going to be up to the people who run the big pension schemes as to whether or not they feel that they can invest in the projects that she's talking about. So there will have to be some sort of return on investment. You can't force pension schemes to invest in certain things because they've got distinct responsibilities to the people that they need to pay the pensions out to. And so although they hold a lot of money, there are an awful lot of people who are, you know, members who will eventually retire and then need to be paid their pensions. So they can't, there is an inbuilt level of cautiousness, if you like, because they can't, the people who manage the pension schemes can't do something that would then lay them open to charges of maladministration. So any changes has to be made very carefully. I did a big investigation, actually, when I was the chair of oversight just last year, and we looked at pensions to see whether or not they could change what they invest in, and we called in the people who run the whole of the local government pension scheme for most London authorities. So most of the GLA is invested in it. The GLA's own pension investments are a bit complicated because the Greater London Family is Greater London Authority is a family of different organisations. It's not just one body. So you've got Transport for London, which has more than one pension. And Transport for London is a bit odd because it's sort of it's a public sector body, but it's got a private sector pension because of various reasons in the past. It's actually quite hard to change the way that that's dealt with. And then you've also got the Metropolitan Police, which has got more than one pension. You've also got the Fire Brigade, ditto, because quite often there's been changes made to the way that the pensions are administered for various employees with dates of retirement. When they've had sort of the calculation has been done on 80th or 60th of salary and all this kind of thing. So even changing things like that or bringing them in line so that all employees have the same arrangements, let alone where you invest the assets, we looked at all of those in detail. I was particularly interested in this issue of where the money is invested, and it's something you can make a speech about and say these things, but to then change the way that pension funds invest their money is a bit more difficult when you get down to the practical nuts and bolts of the whole thing. We made some recommendations to the mayor in terms of the approach that we thought should be taken, and some recommendations to the pension authority. But it's complicated when you look into the details,
isn't it? But presumably this is a key driver of how Starmer's ambitions could be achieved. Do you see this having legs, Mal? And do you see how do you see the sea change that Reeve seems to be angling for, and how on the basis of how it's worked elsewhere?
Well, as Leonie says, pension schemes have to. If they're going to make an investment, it has to be on a fairly firm belief that that investment is going to be making profits at the time when the call on the, you know, when the pensioners on whose behalf it's being invested come to drawing their pensions. And it seems to me there's echoes in here of the private finance initiative that if to attract the, well, or to, yeah, if in effect you're talking of spending the state provision, pension provision in this sort of way, then there needs to be a pretty firm belief that these projects are going to be delivering a profit to shareholders in due course. And that was what got us into trouble over the private finance initiative. It looked very nice at the time that you could get very considerable amounts of private money in to build new hospitals and and repair schools and other very, extremely worthwhile things to do. But the firms that were investing would only do so on the assumption that they were going to make a very large amount of money out of it in due course, which is, of course, what happened. And that very large amount of money has been a millstone around the public sector's neck for many years now. And I just don't see how you can set this up whereby you are going to persuade somebody that they're going to make a huge profit out of public sector projects at some point in the future, without then saddling that generation with exactly the same problems that this generation is facing, owing to the private finance initiative.
Yeah. Graham, what's your reading of it?
Well, I think it could establish the Labour Party as economic wizards, if it works.
Is it too high a gamble, though?
Well, I mean, the politicians have been after the pension pots for years.
A coin of phrase, yeah.
It's a huge capital base, and if they can, it does make sense for local authorities and to the country as a whole to be able to use the capital. Then it is a question of the detail, but and they've got that wrong in the energy sector, for example, by investing in the wrong technology. And you only make money out of technologies that work and make a profit. So you have to rely on the experts who know how to take carbon out of the atmosphere to do it as a profit, which the Chinese do. And this is why they've gone ahead and are cleaning up on the renewable energy industry. And Biden has come in at a late stage, but is also succeeding, except for the fact that the Republicans and the fossil industry are taking all the funds in subsidy.
Yes, I mean, I guess you're alluding to the Inflation Reduction Act, which politically was, is, I suppose, perhaps not the best phrase, Biden's Trump card. But as I think the Democrats said remorsefully, the payout of that is going to take an awful long time. People are comforted by the ethical direction, if that's their belief. But this is the paradox with, I guess, with ethical investment, isn't it?
Well, that's where
But
you need
there's a
modern
further
political.
angle, which is just the experience we've had in local government in this country of local authorities, in effect, doing this, becoming speculators in
Yes,
property markets or
here in
whatever.
Croydon for a while, yes.
And you end up with Croydon, you end up with Woking, you end up with Northamptonshire, you end up with Birmingham. That public sector bodies, generally speaking, have not got a great record of choosing the winners in this scheme. And if it's horrendous of what's happening with council tax in places like Croydon, as the authorities try to claw back some of the money and the levels of cuts of services in Birmingham that follow. If you imagine that you've gambled your national pension fund away on failed projects of this nature, because there are no, it's if anything is blindingly obviously going to make money, then you don't need government involved because the private sector will do it. But nothing is blindingly obvious it's going to make money. Every project has risk associated with it. Some of them have higher risks than others, and therefore deserve higher rewards than others. But there are no absolute guarantees in life. Even the major banks
Toll
face
roads,
problems
toll
in the.
roads, toll roads make good money, and they can make money for many, many years after the tolls have actually paid for the construction of the road that's tolled or the tunnel that's tolled. So the M6 toll, the Clifton suspension bridge, in fact, they've taken the toll off the road that goes in and out of Wales, the Prince of Wales Bridge. They don't toll it anymore because it made money for so long. And
Now, there's a thought.
when well, they're going to toll the Silvertown Tunnel to pay for the Silvertown Tunnel. because that's cost about 2 billion quid. And for ages, we've had these ludicrous resolutions from the Greens saying the £2 billion that's being spent by this administration on the Silvertown Tunnel could be spent on this, that, and the other. And no, the administration is not spending any money on it. You know, another company is putting its hand in its pocket and is building the tunnel, and is the tolls will then give them the money back that they've spent on the project, because they've been saying, oh, the tolls will come off, the tolls won't really happen. No, the tolls really will happen, because that's how the project is being paid for. So tolling roads. We've also raised green finance to go into ULEZ, because obviously that makes money as well. You know, people are charged.
Understanding that people dispatching the cameras and things like that, the cost of that, but yeah,
so people are being taken to court about all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But because they have indeed smashed the cameras and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you toll things, or if you've got a zone where people have to pay to come in and out, that does create an obvious income. The other thing that really does pay for itself quite quickly, although they're quite expensive in the first place, are wind turbines. They really do coin it in as well. I worked with someone when I was working in Lincolnshire, and he lived not far from the office, and Lincolnshire is quite flat and quite windy. And although he'd spent 20 grand putting a wind turbine onto his own land, it more than paid for itself within about 6 months. And then he was just coining it in after that, so he was very pleased with that. But so if you put up a wind farm somewhere, it will pay for itself.
But no, quickly.
But you
because
know,
of the subsidy ratio.
But my you know, my money, which I have saved, which I have said I won't take this part of my salary, I will put that into my pension. And the local authority, or the Greater London Authority, as it is in my case, who then said, oh, well, if you put in that amount of money, then we'll put in this amount of money. So it's deferred salary, and it's an additional amount that's put in by the employer that you don't see. All of that money is all sitting there in accounts for me and many other hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I don't want that invested in, I don't know, something that's going to make no money at all, that's pretty crucial or essential. I don't know, let's say the Thames Barrier, that's a big infrastructure project, that is not going to create any kind of income stream for anyone, unless you start to toll.
Not even the trickle-down effect. Yep.
No, unless you're going to charge people to sort of, you know, bring a ship or boat past it, which no one's talking about doing. You know, where's the income that comes from putting my pension fund into the Thames Barrier? I can't understand where that would come from. And, you know, there's no obvious income. So I can see the money being invested into things that create a return on investment. I cannot see how you can persuade green finance. It's much more difficult to persuade green finance to, you know, to be put into projects that have no return on investment, where there's no obvious income stream.
I suppose the argument might be quality of life and the proficiencies of other enterprises on the back of the green investment being made. But, yeah.
No, they have to invest it. They have to invest it so that it accrues in value.
Mm.
That is the underlying ethos of a pension fund. And if you're running a pension fund and you put money into something that is just sort of, you know, something that we all want, or it's very nice, and it doesn't accrue in value, and then the value of the fund goes down, then you've got people who will retire and become pensioners and who want to draw the money down out of the fund, who won't be able to do so. And which is why people who run pension funds, you know, they can't do that. They can't invest in things just because they're nice or things that we want them. You know, want things to change. And so the government will have to bite the bullet about, I mean, I'm sure there will be people who want to invest in Great British Energy, because, as I just said, you know, and whether it's through subsidies or whatever, you know, it will make some money. It must do, and it will be selling energy to people. But you know, investing in schemes where there's no obvious return on investment, no income is going to come back in, I would have thought that would be maladministration for the pension administrators to put their money into schemes like that.
Yeah, well, I think pretty much a burning issue of our times. So I suppose, and it's a somber note on which I guess to pause for now, the Justin Welby resignation and the fact that it's taken the best part of what 14 years for the horrendous behaviour of John Smythe to come to the attention of the General Synod, formerly in the Macon report.
I hate to say it, but I think reports were being made to the church from a lot longer ago in time.
You're quite right.
But
It just they just seem to have been pushed aside for some reason.
probably longer ago than when Justin Welby became the Archbishop. Still, I mean, things are looking up for him. He's now available to go back into the oil industry if he wants to, I suppose. You know, having left that, he could go back to his old profession. No, I mean it's. I mean, I was just completely astonished when it became apparent that a report had been made to him, and he had literally done nothing. So I would have. I mean, it was just astonishing. But I guess the only thing that makes me understand all of these, you know, we've just been hearing for weeks now about Mohammed Al-Fayed, 400 women
And his
now,
brother, apparently,
and now also
allegedly.
a couple of complaints about his brother. You know, there's Jimmy Savile. There are all these sort of industrial scale people who've you know, done all these horrible things. And we had one at my school, as I think I may have said before, who molested young boys and beat them. The same kind of, you know, sadosexual, made them pull their pants down, beat them, and it went on for years and years and years. Loads of us tried to report it. We were all ignored and treated as though we were mad. He left from being the deputy head of our school and was made the head of a boys' school, and then carried on his career of beating and fondling and, you know, all the rest of it. Young boys, always boys whose voices had not yet broken, you know, they were the youngest boys, until he eventually somebody believed somebody, and he was stopped, and he hanged himself before he could be sentenced. So, I mean, I have had personal experience of trying to, you know, nobody listens to you. Is the bottom line. Not as children. It's very difficult. I don't know. Grown-ups just don't seem to want to. And even when there is a report done by other grown-ups, they seem to want to ignore it. I just think it becomes so enormously. I don't know. It just seems to be an inability to deal with this sort of thing. And so Welby's not the first person to have failed to step up and deal with it. And I'm sure it won't be the last. There will be other examples. Cyril Smith. I mean, there's been politicians as well. Cyril Smith was accused of all sorts of things. Greville Janner. I know his family were, you know, very upset when accusations were made. But I know people who were molested by Greville Janner when they were very, you know, young political interns. So, you know, I mean, these things go on in all institutions, and it turns out that no institution is immune from it. There's a great film which I think is called, is it Spotlight? And it's the Boston Globe journalists investigating the Catholic Church in America. And it's, you know, no one has listened to all these people who've been saying, you know, our children have been molested.
Yeah, and
The
one thinks of
starting
Trump
point.
and Epstein and all that. Yeah, and indeed Gates allegedly. Sorry, Mal.
And so the starting point has to be that if you have any activity or profession which allows people to have pretty much untrammeled access to young children, where people will have a strong inclination to believe that there's nothing dodgy going on when there is, then that will attract people of that nature, and you have to be particularly careful about it. So it's not, of course, that all priests in the Church of England or the Catholic Church, or that all school teachers, or that all sports coaches, or that all drag queens, or whatever you care to take the view. It's obviously not the case that they are, or by any means, all paedophiles, but it is quite likely that paedophiles will gravitate into those areas. So you have to be doubly
That's a risk
careful that
assessment. Yeah.
the safeguarding is going on. And there's been a string of cases of people convicted of paedophile charges getting suspended sentences or getting community sentences recently, suggesting that the judicial system at the moment, and whether that's from directions from the Justice Department or whether it's the judiciary in itself, taking a view that these are not terribly serious offences when compared, for example, to tweeting about a riot, which can get you, you know, 3 years in prison. While that's the case, and I don't know what the wider statistics are about this, but there are a lot of documented evidence, documented cases floating around on Twitter at the moment about this, then if society as a whole is kind of saying, well, we'll find excuses not to lock you up if you have you know, child abuse, or you've and there are a number of high profile figures now who didn't get jail sentences despite very, very high profile cases involving child pornography. I do wonder whether we need to reassess that there's a whole new string of these sex offences being committed now, and they don't seem to be taking all that seriously now, despite, as Leonie says, what we would hope to have learned from a whole string of these activities across a range of different activities.
The sort of mission creep, in a sense, then. And I suppose people think about, and again, I don't wish to stereotype it, the somewhat sclerotic process of a body such as the General Synod, which can take years to debate matters incrementally, which could be seen to be very fair, but at the same time, the ability for people to hide in plain sight while that pace is a thing, comes home to roost eventually. And you think across the pond of Trump parading his entire family, while we know that he's had associations that are distinctly unhealthy and unpropitious. Graham.
Well, personal experience in training for the bar was that we had a QC come in and explain that sexual cases were so horrific that barristers were not too keen to take them on. They always preferred some other area of work. And that's the interesting point about the inter-elite fighting, is that they've gone for the church rather than the legal profession. And I would have thought the professional practice of lawyers, you know, he's a QC, he was a QC, he should have been found by the legal profession rather than the church. You know, he's only tangentially involved in the church. So, I mean, you can, I think
it's a very important point.
All the blame onto the non-guilty culprit.
So the implication is you can, as it were, kick these things into the long grass by choosing the arena in which they're debated. And, you know, the fig leaf of respectability, as it were.
Well, it is. Manipulation, as Leonie said, it's the behavior of people. I mean, people don't like to be involved in it, which is quite understandable. So that's the problem to address, is how to solve it. I mean, it's the reason that people have got away with it for so long.
Yeah.
It's so distasteful. And you can draw analogies with the sewage problem as well.
That's pretty pertinently, yes. If I could just introduce a completely opposite upswing to conclude for now, an organisation called Sparkle, headed up by Emma Chisholm, who is childless, has just opened up its third branch in Earlsfield this week in southwest London. It's devoted to intergenerationality, young children of three or four with septuagenarians and above. It's this singing and making things, but also Emma refers to the inculcation of empathy among very young people, and the fact that she notes that seniors these days very often find themselves adrift or aside or separated from family or just have chosen not to have children. What is this going to help us have a more of a listening brief to the matters like this and matters that are, I guess, more wholesome and propitious?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, a number of, when I had the education brief, I was always impressed with many of our secondary schools, in effect, ran similar projects as part of their encouraging youngsters to take volunteering seriously, where they would set up a kind of almost a task force among the older pupils, who would go around to, you know, elderly people who were expressing an interest and just help out, you know, would just, you know, do stuff around the house, would just sit and talk. And yeah, you know, loneliness is a big problem in society for older people, and has been noticeably growing as such for some time. And this, I think, is it's one of those things where everybody gains from it. I think the young people gain from the human contact with another generation, but also the experience that they can offer of life. Clearly, the elderly people have folk coming into the home and addressing the possibility of loneliness. As always, you've got to be very careful about safeguarding, sadly, because there will be those who will try to use this for their own benefit. But generally speaking, it sounds to me a wonderful idea, and I'm sure it'll be a great success.
Yeah. Leomi, how do you feel about the advent of Sparkle?
Yeah, I think it's everything that Malcolm has just said. I know quite a few other people who've done similar intergenerational projects, and I think you know, there's much much benefit to all parties of whatever age from spending time with people of different ages because they've had different life experiences and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, you know, and a great name actually. I like the name Sparkle.
It's lovely, yes, isn't it? Well, I hope the week is sparkling, Graham. I have been musing on the idea of how you might design intergenerationality into the public square. Do you think this is a way to do it?
Yeah, through education. And the psychological makeup of the development programs. I mean, I think that's what is coming, obviously, is the awareness that technology has alienating effects. And it needs to be active promotion of human development rather than machine development. And I think that's one of the things that AI and digital technologies are going to have to address as the first thing they've had to address is the youth corruption and sexual perversion.
Oh, good Lord, yes, yeah. I think one of the interesting things about the Southwest London is reportage about Sparkle is there's not a computer in sight, which is probably a welcome relief. Anyway, howsoever, lady and gents, have a sparkling weekend. See you next time.
See you.
Bye. Bye.